important. After Timothy McVeigh blew up a federal office building in Oklahoma City in 1995, killing 168 people, the journalist Alfie Cohn ridiculed Americans who yammer about individual responsibility and attributed the bombing to American individualism. We have a cultural addiction to competition in this country. We're taught in classrooms and playing fields that other people are obstacles to our own success. A related explanation for the bombing put the blame on American symbols, such as the arrow-clutching eagle on the national seal, and state mottos, including Live Free or Die, New Hampshire, and With the Sword We Seek Peace But Under Liberty, Massachusetts. A popular recent theory attributes American violence to a toxic and peculiarly American conception of maleness inculcated in childhood. The social psychologist Alice Eagley explained sprees of random shootings by saying, "This sort of behavior has been part of the male role as it has been construed in U.S. culture from the frontier tradition on." According to the theory, popularized in bestsellers like Dan Kindlin's Raising Cain and William Pollack's Real Boys, we are going through a national crisis of boyhood in America, caused by the fact that boys are forced to separate from their mothers and stifle their emotions. "What's the matter with men?" asked an article in the Boston Globe magazine. "Violent behavior, emotional distance, and higher rates of drug addiction can't be explained by hormones," it answers. "The problem," experts say, "is cultural beliefs about masculinity. Everything packed into the phrase, a real man." The statement that violence is learned behavior is a mantra repeated by right-thinking people to show that they believe that violence should be reduced. It is not based on any sound research. The sad fact is that despite the repeated assurances that we know the conditions that breed violence, we barely have a clue. Wild swings in crime rates, up in the 1960s and late 1980s, down in the late 1990s, continued to defy any simple explanation. And the usual suspects for understanding violence are completely unproven and sometimes patently false. This is most blatant in the case of factors like nutrition and disease that are glibly thrown into lists of the social ills that allegedly bring on violence. There is no evidence, to put it mildly, that violence is caused by a vitamin deficiency or a bacterial infection. But the other putative causes suffer from a lack of evidence as well. Aggressive parents often have aggressive children, but people who conclude that aggression is learned from parents in a cycle of violence never consider the possibility that violent tendencies could be inherited as well as learned. Unless one looks at adopted children and shows that they act more like their adoptive parents than their biological parents, cycles of violence prove nothing. Similarly, the psychologists who note that men commit more acts of violence than women and then blame it on a culture of masculinity are wearing intellectual blinkers that keep them from noticing that men and women differ in their biology as well as in their social roles. American children are exposed to violent role models, of course, but they are also exposed to clowns, preachers, folk singers, and drag queens. The question is why children find some people more worthy of imitation than others. To show that violence is caused by special themes of American culture, a bare minimum of evidence would be a correlation in which the cultures that have those themes also tend to be more violent. Even that correlation, if it existed, would not prove that the cultural themes cause the violence rather than the other way around. But there may be no such correlation in the first place. To begin with, American culture is not uniquely violent. All societies have violence, and America is not the most violent one in history or even in today's world. Most countries in the Third World and many of the former republics of the Soviet Union are considerably more violent, and they have nothing like the American tradition of individualism. As for cultural norms of masculinity and sexism, Spain has its machismo, Italy its braggadocio, and Japan its rigid gender roles, yet their homicide rates are a fraction of that of the more feminist-influenced United States. The archetype of a masculine hero prepared to use violence in a just cause is one of the most common motifs in mythology, and it can be found in many cultures with relatively low rates of violent crime. James Bond, for example, who actually has a license to kill, is British, and martial arts films are popular in many industrialized Asian countries. In any case, only a bookworm who has never actually seen an American movie or television program could believe that they glorify murderous fanatics like Timothy McVeigh, or teenagers who randomly shoot classmates in high school cafeterias. Masculine heroes in the mass media are highly moralistic. They fight bad guys. Among conservative politicians and liberal health professionals alike, it is an article of faith that violence in the media is a major cause of American violent crime. The American Medical Association, the American Psychological Association, and the American Academy of Pediatrics testified before Congress that over 3,500 studies had investigated the connection and only 18 failed to find one. Any social scientist can smell fishy numbers here, and the psychologist Jonathan Friedman decided to look for himself. In fact, only 200 studies have looked for a connection between media violence and violent behavior, and more than half failed to find one. The others found correlations that are small and readily explainable in other ways. For example, that violent children seek out violent entertainment, and that children are temporarily aroused, but not permanently affected, by action-packed footage. Friedman and several other psychologists who have reviewed the literature have concluded that exposure to media violence has little or no effect on violent behavior in the world. Reality checks from recent history suggest the same thing. People were more violent in the centuries before television and movies were invented. Canadians watch the same television shows as Americans, but have a fourth their homicide rate. When the British colony of St. Helena installed television for the first time in 1995, its people did not become more violent. Violent computer games took off in the 1990s, a time when crime rates plummeted. What about the other usual suspects? Guns, discrimination, and poverty play a role in violence, but in no case is it a simple or decisive one. Guns surely make it easier for people to kill, and harder for them to de-escalate a fight before a death occurs, and thus multiply the lethality of conflicts large and small. Nonetheless, many societies had sickening rates of violence before guns were invented, and people do not automatically kill one another just because they have access to guns. The Israelis and Swiss are armed to the teeth, but have low rates of violent personal crime. And among American states, Maine and North Dakota have the lowest homicide rates, but almost every home has a gun. The idea that guns increase lethal crime, though certainly plausible, has been so difficult to prove that in 1998, the legal scholar John Lott published a book of statistical analyses with a title that flaunts the opposite conclusion. More guns, less crime. Even if he is wrong, as I suspect he is, it is not so easy to show that more guns mean more crime. As for discrimination and poverty, again, it is hard to show a direct cause and effect relationship. Chinese immigrants to California in the 19th century and Japanese Americans in World War II faced severe discrimination, but they did not react with high rates of violence. Women are poorer than men and are more likely to need money to feed children, but they are less likely to steal things by force. Different subcultures that are equally impoverished can vary radically in their rates of violence, and as we shall see, in many cultures, relatively affluent men can be quick to use lethal force. Though no one could object to a well-designed program that was shown to reduce crime, one cannot simply blame crime rates on a lack of commitment to social programs. These programs first flourished in the 1960s, the decade in which rates of violent crime skyrocketed. Scientifically oriented researchers on violence chant a different mantra. Violence is a public health problem. According to the National Institute of Mental Health, violent behavior can best be understood and prevented if it is attacked as if it were a contagious disease that flourishes in vulnerable individuals and resource-poor neighborhoods. The public health theory has been echoed by many professional organizations, such as the American Psychological Society and the Centers for Disease Control, and by political figures as diverse as the Surgeon General in the Clinton administration and the Republican Senator Arlen Specter. The public health approach tries to identify risk factors that are more common in poor neighborhoods than affluent ones. They include neglect and abuse in childhood, harsh and inconsistent discipline, divorce, malnutrition, lead poisoning, head injuries, untreated attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and the use of alcohol and crack cocaine during pregnancy. Researchers in this tradition are proud that their approach is both biological, they measure bodily fluids and take pictures of the brain, and cultural, they look for environmental causes of the brain conditions that might be ameliorated by the equivalent of public health measures. Unfortunately, there is a rather glaring flaw in the whole analogy. A good definition of a disease or disorder is that it consists of suffering experienced by an individual because of a malfunction of a mechanism in the individual's body. But as a writer for Science recently pointed out, unlike most diseases, it's usually not the perpetrator who defines aggression as a problem. It's the environment. Violent people may feel they are functioning normally, and some may even enjoy their occasional outbursts and resist treatment. Other than the truism that violence is more common in some people and places than others, the public health theory has little to recommend it. As we shall see, violence is not a disease in anything like the medical sense. Pure environmental theories of violence remain an article of faith, because they embody the blank slate and the noble savage. Violence, according to these theories, isn't a natural strategy in the human repertoire. It's learned behavior, or poisoning by a toxic substance, or the symptoms of an infectious illness. In earlier chapters, we saw the moral appeal of such doctrines. To differentiate the doctrine holders from jingoists of earlier periods and ruffians of different classes, to reassure audiences that they do not think violence is natural in the sense of good, to express an optimism that violence can be eliminated, particularly by benign social programs rather than punitive deterrents, to stay miles away from the radioactive position that some individuals, classes, or races are innately more violent than others. Most of all, the learned behavior and public health theories are moral declarations, public avowals that the declarer is opposed to violence. Condemning violence is all to the good, of course, but not if it is disguised as an empirical claim about our psychological makeup. Perhaps the purest example of this wishful confusion comes from Ramsey Clark, Attorney General in the Johnson administration and the author of the 1970 bestseller, Crime in America. In arguing that the criminal justice system should replace punishment with rehabilitation, Clark explained, "The theory of rehabilitation is based on the belief that healthy, rational people will not injure others, that they will understand that the individual and his society are best served by conduct that does not inflict injury, and that a just society has the ability to provide health and purpose and opportunity for all its citizens. Rehabilitated, an individual will not have the capacity, cannot bring himself, to injure another or take or destroy property." Would that it were so. This theory is a fine example of the moralistic fallacy. It would be so nice if the idea were true, that we should all believe that it is true. The problem is that it is not true. History has shown that plenty of healthy, rational people can bring themselves to injure others and destroy property because, tragically, an individual's interests sometimes are served by hurting others. Especially if criminal penalties for hurting others are eliminated, an irony that Clark seems to have missed. Conflicts of interest are inherent to the human condition. And as Martin Daly and Margot Wilson point out, killing one's adversary is the ultimate conflict resolution technique. Admittedly, it is easy to equate health and rationality with morality. The metaphors pervade the English language, as when we call an evildoer crazy, degenerate, depraved, deranged, mad, malignant, psycho, sick, or twisted. But the metaphors are bound to mislead us when we contemplate the causes of violence and ways to reduce it. Termites are not malfunctioning when they eat the wooden beams in houses, nor are mosquitoes when they bite a victim and spread the malaria parasite. They are doing exactly what evolution designed them to do, even if the outcome makes people suffer. For scientists to moralize about these creatures or call their behavior pathological would only send us all down blind alleys, such as a search for the toxic influences on these creatures or a cure that would restore them to health. For the same reason, human violence does not have to be a disease for it to be worth combating. If anything, it is the belief that violence is an aberration that is dangerous because it lulls us into forgetting how easily violence may erupt in quiescent places. The blank slate and the noble savage owe their support not just to their moral appeal, but to enforcement by ideology police. The blood libel against Napoleon Chagnon for documenting warfare among the Yanomamo is the most lurid example of the punishment of heretics, but it is not the only one. In 1992, a violence initiative in the Alcohol, Drug Abuse, and Mental Health Administration was canceled because of false accusations that the research aimed to sedate inner-city youth and to stigmatize them as genetically prone to violence. In fact, it advocated the public health approach. A conference and book on the legal and moral issues surrounding the biology of violence, which was to include advocates of all viewpoints, was canceled by Bernadine Healy, director of the National Institutes of Health, who overruled a unanimous peer review decision because of concerns associated with the sensitivity and validity of the proposed conference. The university sponsoring the conference appealed and won, but when the conference was held 3 years later, protesters invaded the hall and, as if to provide material for comedians, began a shoving match with the participants. What was everyone so sensitive about? The stated fear was that the government would define political unrest in response to inequitable social conditions as a psychiatric disease and silence the protesters by drugging them or worse. The radical psychiatrist Peter Breggin called the violence initiative the most terrifying, most racist, most hideous thing imaginable, and the kind of plan one would associate with Nazi Germany. The reasons included the medicalization of social issues, the declaration that the victim of oppression, in this case the Jew, is in fact a genetically and biologically defective person, the mobilization of the state for eugenic purposes and biological purposes, the heavy use of psychiatry in the development of social control programs. This is a fanciful, indeed paranoid reading, but Breggin has tirelessly repeated it, especially to African-American politicians and media outlets. Anyone using the words violence and biology in the same paragraph may be put under a cloud of suspicion for racism, and this has affected the intellectual climate regarding violence. No one has ever gotten into trouble for saying that violence is completely learned. There are many reasons to believe that violence in humans is not literally a sickness or poisoning, but part of our design. Before presenting them, let me allay two fears. The first fear is that examining the roots of violence in human nature consists of reducing violence to the bad genes of violent individuals, with the unsavory implication that ethnic groups with higher rates of violence must have more of these genes. There can be little doubt that some individuals are constitutionally more prone to violence than others. Take men, for starters. Across cultures, men kill men 20 to 40 times more often than women kill women. And the lion's share of the killers are young men between the ages of 15 and 30. Some young men, moreover, are more violent than others. According to one estimate, 7% of young men commit 79% of repeated violent offenses. Psychologists find that individuals prone to violence have a distinctive personality profile. They tend to be impulsive, low in intelligence, hyperactive, and attention deficit. They are described as having an oppositional temperament. They are vindictive, easily angered, resistant to control, deliberately annoying, and likely to blame everything on other people. The most callous among them are psychopaths, people who lack a conscience, and they make up a substantial percentage of murderers. These traits emerge in early childhood, persist through the lifespan, and are largely heritable, though nowhere near completely so. sadists, hotheads, and other natural-born killers are part of the problem of violence, not just because of the harm they wreak, but because of the aggressive posture they force others into for deterrence and self-defense. But my point here is that they are not the major part of the problem. Wars start and stop, crime rates yo-yo, societies go from militant to pacifist or vice versa within a generation, all without any change in the frequencies of the local genes. Though ethnic groups differ today in their average rates of violence, the differences do not call for a genetic explanation, because the rate for a group at one historical period may be matched to that of any other group at another period. Today's docile Scandinavians descended from bloodthirsty Vikings, and Africa, racked by war after the fall of colonialism, is much like Europe after the fall of the Roman Empire. Any ethnic group that has made it into the present probably had pugnacious ancestors in the not-too-distant past. The second fear is that if people are endowed with violent motives, they can't help being violent or must be violent all the time, like the Tasmanian devil in Looney Tunes, who tears through an area leaving a swath of destruction in his wake. This fear is a reaction to archaic ideas of killer apes, a thirst for blood, a death wish, a territorial imperative, and a violent brain. In fact, if the brain is equipped with strategies for violence, they are contingent strategies, connected to complicated circuitry that computes when and where they should be deployed. Animals deploy aggression in highly selective ways, and humans, whose limbic systems are enmeshed with outsized frontal lobes, are of course even more calculating. Most people today live their adult lives without ever pressing their violence buttons. So what is the evidence that our species may have evolved mechanisms for discretionary violence? The first thing to keep in mind is that aggression is an organized, goal-directed activity, not the kind of event that could come from a random malfunction. If your lawnmower continued to run after you released the handle and it injured your foot, you might suspect a sticky switch or other breakdown. But if the lawnmower lay in wait until you emerged from the garage and then chased you around the yard, you would have to conclude that someone had installed a chip that programmed it to do so. The presence of deliberate chimpicide in our chimpanzee cousins raises the possibility that the forces of evolution, not just the idiosyncrasies of a particular human culture, prepared us for violence. And the ubiquity of violence in human societies throughout history and prehistory is a stronger hint that we are so prepared. When we look at human bodies and brains, we find more direct signs of design for aggression. The larger size, strength, and upper body mass of men is a zoological giveaway of an evolutionary history of violent male-male competition. Other signs include the effects of testosterone on dominance and violence, which we will encounter in the chapter on gender, the emotion of anger, complete with reflexive baring of the canine teeth and clenching of the fists, the revealingly named fight-or-flight response of the autonomic nervous system, and the fact that disruptions of inhibitory systems of the brain, by alcohol, damage to the frontal lobe or amygdala, or defective genes involved in serotonin metabolism, can lead to aggressive attacks initiated by circuits in the limbic system. Boys in all cultures spontaneously engage in rough-and-tumble play, which is obviously practice for fighting. They also divide themselves into coalitions that compete aggressively, calling to mind the remark attributed to the Duke of Wellington that the Battle of Waterloo was won upon the playing fields of Eton. And children are violent well before they have been infected by war toys or cultural stereotypes. The most violent age is not adolescence but toddlerhood. In a recent large study, almost half the boys just past the age of 2 and a slightly smaller percentage of the girls engaged in hitting, biting, and kicking. As the author pointed out, babies do not kill each other because we do not give them access to knives and guns. The question we've been trying to answer for the past 30 years is how do children learn to aggress? But that's the wrong question. The right question is how do they learn not to aggress? Violence continues to preoccupy the mind throughout life. According to independent surveys in several countries by the psychologists Douglas Kendrick and David Buss, More than 80% of women and 90% of men fantasize about killing people they don't like, especially romantic rivals, step-parents, and people who have humiliated them in public. People in all cultures take pleasure in thinking about killings. If we are to judge by the popularity of murder mysteries, crime dramas, spy thrillers, Shakespearean tragedies, biblical stories, hero myths, and epic poems. A character in Tom Stoppard's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead asks, "You're familiar with the great tragedies of antiquity, are you? The great homicidal classics?" People also enjoy watching the stylized combat we call sports, which are contests of aiming, chasing, or fighting, complete with victors and the vanquished. If language is a guide, many other efforts are conceptualized as forms of aggression. Intellectual argument, to shoot down defeat or destroy an idea or its proponent. Social reform, to fight crime, to combat prejudice, the war on poverty, the war on drugs. And medical treatment, to fight cancer, painkillers, to defeat AIDS, the war on cancer. In fact, the entire question of what went wrong, socially or biologically, when a person engages in violence is badly posed. Almost everyone recognizes the need for violence in defense of self, family, and innocent victims. Moral philosophers point out that there are even circumstances in which torture is justified. Say, when a captured terrorist has planted a time bomb in a crowded place and refuses to say where it is. More generally, whether a violent mindset is called heroic or pathological often depends on whose ox has been gored. Freedom fighter or terrorist, Robin Hood or thief, guardian angel or vigilante, nobleman or warlord, martyr or kamikaze, general or gang leader. These are value judgments, not scientific classifications. I doubt that the brains or genes of most of the lauded protagonists would differ from those of their vilified counterparts. In this way, I find myself in agreement with the radical scientists who insist that we will never understand violence by looking only at the genes or brains of violent people. Violence is a social and political problem, not just a biological and psychological one. Nonetheless, the phenomena we call social and political are not external happenings that mysteriously affect human affairs like sunspots. They are shared understandings among individuals at a given time and place. So one cannot understand violence without a thorough understanding of the human mind. In the rest of this chapter, I explore the logic of violence and why emotions and thoughts devoted to it may have evolved. This is necessary to disentangle the knot of biological and cultural causes that make violence so puzzling. It can help explain why people are prepared for violence, but act on those inclinations only in particular circumstances. When violence is, at least in some sense, rational, and when it is blatantly self-defeating. Why violence is more prevalent in some times and places than in others, despite a lack of any genetic difference among the actors. And ultimately, how we might reduce and prevent violence. The first step in understanding violence is to set aside our abhorrence of it long enough to examine why it can sometimes pay off in personal or evolutionary terms. This requires one to invert the statement of the problem, not why violence occurs, but why it is avoided. Morality, after all, did not enter the universe with the Big Bang and then pervade it like background radiation. It was discovered by our ancestors after billions of years of the morally indifferent process known as natural selection. In my view, the consequences of this background amorality were best worked out by Hobbes in Leviathan. Unfortunately, Hobbes's pithy phrase, nasty, brutish, and short, and his image of an all-powerful Leviathan keeping us from each other's throats, have led people to misunderstand his argument. Hobbes is commonly interpreted as proposing that man in a state of nature was saddled with an irrational impulse for hatred and destruction. In fact, his analysis is more subtle, and perhaps even more tragic, for he showed how the dynamics of violence fall out of interactions among rational and self-interested agents. Hobbes's analysis has been rediscovered by evolutionary biology, game theory, and social psychology, and I will use it to organize my discussion of the logic of violence before turning to the ways in which humans deploy peaceable instincts to counteract their violent ones. Here is the analysis that preceded the famous Life of Man passage. So that in the nature of man, we find three principal causes of quarrel. First, competition. Second, diffidence. Thirdly, glory. The first maketh men invade for gain, the second for safety, and the third for reputation. The first use violence to make themselves masters of other men's persons, wives, children, and cattle. The second to defend them. The third for trifles, as a word, a smile, a different opinion, and any other sign of undervalue, either direct in their persons or by reflection in their kindred, their friends, their nation, their profession, or their name. First, competition. Natural selection is powered by competition, which means that the products of natural selection, survival machines in Richard Dawkins' metaphor, should by default do whatever helps them survive and reproduce. He explains, to a survival machine, another survival machine, which is not its own child or another close relative, is part of its environment, like a rock or a river or a lump of food. It is something that gets in the way, or something that can be exploited. It differs from a rock or a river in one important respect. It is inclined to hit back. This is because it too is a machine that holds its immortal genes in trust for the future, and it too will stop at nothing to preserve them. Natural selection favors genes that control their survival machines in such a way that they make the best use of their environment. This includes making the best use of other survival machines, both of the same and of different species. If an obstacle stands in the way of something an organism needs, it should neutralize the obstacle by disabling or eliminating it. This includes obstacles that happen to be other human beings, say ones that are monopolizing desirable land or sources of food. Even among modern nation-states, raw self-interest is a major motive for war. The political scientist Bruce Bueno de Mesquita analyzed the instigators of 251 real-world conflicts of the past two centuries and concluded that in most cases the aggressor correctly calculated that a successful invasion would be in its national interest. Another human obstacle consists of men who are monopolizing women who could otherwise be taken as wives. Hobbes called attention to the phenomenon without knowing the evolutionary reason, which was provided centuries later by Robert Trivers. The difference in the minimal parental investments of males and females make the reproductive capacity of females a scarce commodity over which males compete. This explains why men are the violent gender, and also why they always have something to fight over, even when their survival needs have been met. Studies of warfare in pre-state societies have confirmed that men do not have to be short of food or land to wage war. They often raid other villages to abduct women, to retaliate for past abductions, or to defend their interests in disputes over exchanges of women for marriage. In societies in which women have more say in the matter, men still compete for women by competing for the status and wealth that tend to attract them. The competition can be violent because, as Daly and Wilson point out, any creature that is recognizably on track toward complete reproductive failure must somehow expend effort, often at risk of death, to try to improve its present life trajectory. Impoverished young men on this track are therefore likely to risk life and limb to improve their chances in the sweepstakes for status, wealth, and mates. In all societies, they are the demographic sector in which the firebrands, delinquents, and cannon fodder are concentrated. One of the reasons the crime rate shot up in the 1960s is that boys from the baby boom began to enter their crime-prone years. Though there are many reasons why countries differ in their willingness to wage war, one factor is simply the proportion of the population that consists of men between the ages of 15 and 29. This whole cynical analysis may not ring true to modern readers, because we cannot think of other people as mere parts of our environment that may have to be neutralized like weeds in a garden. Unless we are psychopaths, we sympathize with other people and cannot blithely treat them as obstacles or prey. Such sympathy, however, has not prevented people from committing all manner of atrocities throughout history and prehistory. The contradiction may be resolved by recalling that people discern a moral circle that may not embrace all human beings, but only the members of their clan, village, or tribe. Inside the circle, fellow humans are targets of sympathy. Outside, they are treated like a rock or a river or a lump of food. In a previous book, I mentioned that the language of the Wari people of the Amazon has a set of noun classifiers that distinguish edible from inedible objects, and that the edible class includes anyone who is not a member of the tribe. This prompted the psychologist Judith Rich Harris to observe. In the Wari dictionary, foods defined as not a Wari, their dinners are a lot of fun, for all but the un-Wari one. Cannibalism is so repugnant to us that for years even anthropologists failed to admit that it was common in prehistory. It is easy to think, could other human beings really be capable of such a depraved act? But of course, animal rights activists have a similarly low opinion of meat-eaters, who not only cause millions of preventable deaths, but do so with utter callousness. Castrating and branding cattle without an anesthetic, impaling fish by the mouth and letting them suffocate in the hold of a boat, boiling lobsters alive. My point is not to make a moral case for vegetarianism, but to shed light on the mindset of human violence and cruelty. History and ethnography suggest that people can treat strangers the way we now treat lobsters. And our incomprehension of such deeds may be compared with animal rights activists' incomprehension of ours. It is no coincidence that Peter Singer, the author of The Expanding Circle, is also the author of Animal Liberation. The observation that people may be morally indifferent to other people who are outside a mental circle immediately suggests an opening for the effort to reduce violence. Understand the psychology of the circle well enough to encourage people to put all of humanity inside it. In earlier chapters, we saw how the moral circle has been growing for millennia, pushed outward by the expanding networks of reciprocity that make other human beings more valuable alive than dead. As Robert Wright has put it, among the many reasons I don't think we should bomb the Japanese is that they built my minivan. Other technologies have contributed to a cosmopolitan view that makes it easy to imagine trading places with other people. These include literacy, travel, a knowledge of history, and realistic art that helps people project themselves into the daily lives of people who in other times might have been their mortal enemies. We have also seen how the circle can shrink. Recall that Jonathan Glover showed that atrocities are often accompanied by tactics of dehumanization, such as the use of pejorative names, degrading conditions, humiliating dress, and cold jokes that make light of suffering. These tactics can flip a mental switch and reclassify an individual from person to non-person, making it as easy for someone to torture or kill him as it is for us to boil a lobster alive. Those who poke fun at politically correct names for ethnic minorities, including me, should keep in mind that they originally had a humane rationale. The social psychologist Philip Zimbardo has shown that even among the students of an elite university, tactics of dehumanization can easily push one person outside another's moral circle. Zimbardo created a mock prison in the basement of the Stanford University Psychology Department and randomly assigned students to the role of prisoner or guard. The prisoners had to wear smocks, leg irons, and nylon stocking caps and were referred to by serial numbers. Before long, the guards began to brutalize them, standing on their backs while they did push-ups, spraying them with fire extinguishers, forcing them to clean toilets with their bare hands, and Zimbardo called off the experiment for the subject's safety. In the other direction, signs of a victim's humanity can occasionally break through and flip the switch back to the sympathy setting. When George Orwell fought in the Spanish Civil War, he once saw a man running for his life half-dressed, holding up his pants with one hand. "I refrained from shooting at him," Orwell wrote. "I did not shoot, partly because of that detail about the trousers. I had come here to shoot at fascists, but a man who is holding up his trousers isn't a fascist. He is visibly a fellow creature, similar to yourself." Glover recounts another example reported by a South African journalist. In 1985, in the old apartheid South Africa, there was a demonstration in Durban. The police attacked the demonstrators with customary violence. One policeman chased a black woman, obviously intending to beat her with his club. As she ran, her shoe slipped off. The brutal policeman was also a well-brought-up young Afrikaner, who knew that when a woman loses her shoe, you pick it up for her. Their eyes met as he handed her the shoe. He then left her, since clubbing her was no longer an option. We should not, however, delude ourselves into thinking that the reaction of Orwell, one of the 20th century's greatest moral voices, and of the well-brought-up Afrikaner is typical. Many intellectuals believe that the majority of soldiers cannot bring themselves to fire their weapons in battle. The claim is incredible on the face of it, given the tens of millions of soldiers who were shot in the wars of the last century. I am reminded of the professor in Stoppard's Jumpers, who noted that Zeno's paradox prevents an arrow from ever reaching its target. So Saint Sebastian must have died of fright. The belief turns out to be traceable to a single, dubious study of infantrymen in World War II. In follow-up interviews, the men denied having ever been asked whether they had fired their weapons, let alone having claimed they hadn't. Recent surveys of soldiers in battle and of rioters in ethnic massacres find that they often kill with gusto, sometimes in a state they describe as joy or ecstasy. Glover's anecdotes reinforce the hope that people are capable of putting strangers inside a violence-proof moral circle. But they also remind us that the default setting may be to keep them out. Secondly, diffidence, in its original sense of distrust. Hobbes had translated Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War, and was struck by his observation that what made war inevitable was the growth of Athenian power and the fear which this caused in Sparta. If you have neighbors, they may covet what you have, in which case you have become an obstacle to their desires. Therefore, you must be prepared to defend yourself. Defense is an iffy matter, even with technologies such as castle walls, the Maginot Line, or anti-ballistic missile defenses, and it is even iffier without them. The only option for self-protection may be to wipe out potentially hostile neighbors first in a preemptive strike, as Yogi Berra advised. The best defense is a good offense and vice versa. Tragically, you might arrive at this conclusion even if you didn't have an aggressive bone in your body. All it would take is the realization that others might covet what you have and a strong desire not to be massacred. Even more tragically, your neighbors have every reason to be cranking through the same deduction, and if they are, it makes your fears all the more compelling, which makes a preemptive strike all the more tempting, which makes a preemptive strike by them all the more tempting, and so on. This Hobbesian trap, as it is now called, is a ubiquitous cause of violent conflict. The political scientist Thomas Schelling offered the analogy of an armed homeowner who surprises an armed burglar. Each might be tempted to shoot first to avoid being shot, even if neither wanted to kill the other. A Hobbesian trap pitting one man against another is a recurring theme in fiction, such as the desperado in Hollywood westerns, spy versus spy plots in Cold War thrillers, and the lyrics to Bob Marley's I Shot the Sheriff. But because we are a social species, Hobbesian traps more commonly pit groups against groups. There is safety in numbers, so humans, bound by shared genes or reciprocal promises, form coalitions for protection. Unfortunately, the logic of the Hobbesian trap means there is also danger in numbers, because neighbors may fear they are becoming outnumbered and form alliances in their turn to contain the growing menace. Since one man's containment is another man's encirclement, this can send the spiral of danger upward. Human sociality is the original entangling alliance in which two parties with no prior animus can find themselves at war when the ally of one attacks the ally of the other. It is the reason I discuss homicide and war in a single chapter. In a species whose members form bonds of loyalty, the first can easily turn into the second. The danger is particularly acute for humans because, unlike most mammals, we tend to be patrilocal, with related males living together instead of dispersing from the group when they become sexually mature. Among chimpanzees and dolphins, related males also live together, and they too form aggressive coalitions. What we call ethnic groups are very large extended families, and though in a modern ethnic group the family ties are too distant for kin-based altruism to be significant, this was not true of the smaller coalitions in which we evolved. Even today, ethnic groups often perceive themselves as large families. And the role of ethnic loyalties in group-against-group violence is all too obvious. The other distinctive feature of Homo sapiens as a species is, of course, tool-making. Competitiveness can channel tool-making into weaponry, and diffidence can channel weaponry into an arms race. An arms race, like an alliance, can make war more likely by accelerating the spiral of fear and distrust. Our species' vaunted ability to make tools is one of the reasons we are so good at killing one another. The vicious circle of a Hobbesian trap can help us understand why the escalation from friction to war, and occasionally the de-escalation to détente, can happen so suddenly. Mathematicians and computer simulators have devised models in which several players acquire arms or form alliances in response to what the other players are doing. The models often display chaotic behavior in which small differences in the values of the parameters can have large and unpredictable consequences. As we can infer from Hobbes's allusion to the Peloponnesian War, Hobbesian traps among groups are far from hypothetical. Chagnon describes how Yanomamo villages obsess over the danger of being massacred by other villages, with good reason, and occasionally engage in preemptive assaults, giving other villages good reason to engage in their own preemptive assaults and prompting groups of villages to form alliances that make their neighbors ever more nervous. Street gangs and mafia families engage in similar machinations. In the past century, World War I, the Six-Day Arab-Israeli War, and the Yugoslavian wars in the 1990s arose in part from Hobbesian traps. The political scientist John Vasquez has made the point quantitatively. Using a database of hundreds of conflicts from the past two centuries, he concludes that the ingredients of a Hobbesian trap, concern with security, entangling alliances and arms races, can statistically predict the escalation of friction into war. The most conscious playing out of the logic of Hobbesian traps took place among nuclear strategists during the Cold War, when the fate of the world literally hinged on it. The logic produced some of the maddening paradoxes of nuclear strategy. Why it is extraordinarily dangerous to have enough missiles to destroy an enemy, but not enough to destroy him after he has attacked those missiles, because the enemy would have a strong incentive to strike preemptively. And why erecting an impregnable defense against enemy missiles could make the world a more dangerous place, because the enemy has an incentive to launch a preemptive strike before the completed defense turns him into a sitting duck. When a stronger group overpowers a weaker one in a surprise raid, it should come as no surprise to a Hobbesian cynic. But when one side defeats another in a battle that both have joined, the logic is not so clear. Given that both the victor and the vanquished have much to lose in a battle, one would expect each side to assess the strength of the other, and the weaker to cede the contested resource without useless bloodshed that would only lead to the same outcome. Most behavioral ecologists believe that rituals of appeasement and surrender among animals evolved for this reason, and not for the good of the species, as Lawrence has supposed. Sometimes the two sides are so well matched, and the stakes of a battle are so high, that they engage in a battle because it is the only way to find out who is stronger. But at other times, a leader will march, or march his men, into the valley of death without any reasonable hope of prevailing. Military incompetence has long puzzled historians, and the primatologist Richard Wrangham suggests that it might grow out of the logic of bluff and self-deception. Convincing an adversary to avoid a battle does not depend on being stronger, but on appearing stronger, and that creates an incentive to bluff and to be good at detecting bluffs. Since the most effective bluffer is the one who believes his own bluff, a limited degree of self-deception in hostile escalations can evolve. It has to be limited, because having one's bluff called can be worse than folding on the first round. But when the limits are miscalibrated and both sides go to the brink, the result can be a human disaster. The historian Barbara Tuchman has highlighted the role of self-deception in calamitous wars throughout history in her books The Guns of August, about World War I, and The March of Folly, from Troy to Vietnam. A readiness to inflict a preemptive strike is a double-edged sword, because it makes one an inviting target for a preemptive strike. So people have invented, and perhaps evolved, an alternative defense, the advertised deterrence policy known as lex talionis, the law of retaliation, familiar from the biblical injunction, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. If you can credibly say to potential adversaries, "We won't attack first, but if we are attacked, we will survive and strike back," you remove Hobbes's first two incentives for quarrel, gain and mistrust. The policy that you will inflict as much harm on others as they inflicted on you cancels their incentive to raid for gain, and the policy that you will not strike first cancels their incentive to raid for mistrust. This is reinforced by the policy to retaliate with no more harm than they inflicted on you, because it allays the fear that you will use a flimsy pretext to justify a massive opportunistic raid. The nuclear strategy of mutual assured destruction is the most obvious contemporary example of the law of retaliation. But it is an explicit version of an ancient impulse, the emotion of vengeance, that may have been installed in our brains by natural selection. Daly and Wilson observe, "In societies from every corner of the world, we can read of vows to avenge a slain father or brother, and of rituals that sanctify those vows, of a mother raising her son to avenge a father who died in the avenger's infancy, of graveside vows, of drinking the deceased kinsman's blood as a covenant, or keeping his bloody garment as a relic." Modern states often find themselves at odds with their citizens' craving for revenge. They prosecute vigilantes, people who take the law into their own hands, and with a few recent exceptions, ignore the clamoring of crime victims and their relatives for a say in decisions to prosecute, plea bargain, or punish. As we saw in Chapter 10, for revenge to work as a deterrent, it has to be implacable. Exacting revenge is a risky business, because if an adversary was dangerous enough to have hurt you in the first place, he is not likely to take punishment lying down. Since the damage has already been done, a coolly rational victim may not see it in his interests to retaliate. And since the aggressor can anticipate this, he could call the victim's bluff and abuse him with impunity. If, on the other hand, potential victims and their kin would be so consumed with the lust for retribution as to raise a son to avenge a slain father, drink the kinsman's blood as a covenant, and so on, an aggressor might think twice before aggressing. The law of retaliation requires that the vengeance have a moralistic pretext to distinguish it from a raw assault. The avenger must have been provoked by a prior act of aggression or other injustice. Studies of feuds, wars, and ethnic violence show that the perpetrators are almost always inflamed by some grievance against their targets. The danger inherent in this psychology is obvious. Two sides may disagree over whether an initial act of violence was justified, perhaps as an act of self-defense, the recovery of ill-gotten gains, or retribution for an earlier offense, or was an act of unprovoked aggression. One side may count an even number of reprisals and feel that the scales of justice have been balanced, while the other side counts an odd number and feels that they still have a score to settle. Self-deception may embolden each side's belief in the rectitude of its cause and make reconciliation almost impossible. Also necessary for vengeance to work as a deterrent is that the willingness to pursue it be made public, because the whole point of deterrence is to give would-be attackers second thoughts beforehand. And this brings us to Hobbes's final reason for quarrel. Thirdly, glory. Though a much more accurate word would be honor. Hobbes's observation that men fight over a word, a smile, a different opinion, and any other sign of undervalue is as true now as it was in the 17th century. For as long as urban crime statistics have been recorded, the most frequent cause of homicide has been argument, what police blotters classify as altercation of relatively trivial origin, insult, curse, jostling, etc. A Dallas homicide detective recalls, "Murders result from little old arguments over nothing at all. Tempers flare. A fight starts and somebody gets stabbed or shot. I've worked on cases where the principals had been arguing over a 10-cent record on a jukebox or over a $1 gambling debt from a dice game. Wars between nation-states are often fought over national honor, even when the material stakes are small. In the late 1960s and early 1970s, most Americans had become disenchanted over their country's involvement in the war in Vietnam, which they thought was immoral or unwinnable or both. But rather than agreeing to withdraw American forces unconditionally, as the peace movement had advocated, a majority supported Richard Nixon and his slogan, "Peace with Honor." In practice, this turned into a slow withdrawal of American troops that prolonged the military presence until 1973, at a cost of 20,000 American lives and the lives of many more Vietnamese, and with the same outcome, defeat of the South Vietnamese government. A defense of national honor was behind other recent wars, such as the British retaking of the Falkland Islands in 1982 and the American invasion of Grenada in 1983. A ruinous 1969 war between El Salvador and Honduras began with a disputed game between their national soccer teams. Because of the logic of deterrence, fights over personal or national honor are not as idiotic as they seem. In a hostile milieu, people and countries must advertise their willingness to retaliate against anyone who would profit at their expense. And that means maintaining a reputation for avenging any slight or trespass, no matter how small. They must make it known that, in the words of the Jim Croce song, you don't tug on Superman's cape, you don't spit into the wind, you don't pull the mask off the old Lone Ranger, and you don't mess around with Jim. The mentality is foreign to those of us who can get Leviathan to show up by dialing 911. But that option is not always available. It was not available to people in pre-state societies, or on the frontier in the Appalachians, or the Wild West, or in the remote highlands of Scotland, the Balkans, or Indochina. It is not available to people who are unwilling to bring in the police because of the nature of their work, so as prohibition rum runners, inner-city drug dealers, and mafia wise guys. And it is not available to nation-states in their dealings with one another. Daly and Wilson comment on the mentality that applies in all these arenas. In chronically feuding and warring societies, an essential manly virtue is the capacity for violence. Headhunting and coup counting may then become prestigious, and the commission of a homicide may even be an obligatory rite of passage. To turn the other cheek is not saintly, but stupid or contemptibly weak. So the social constructionists I cited earlier are not wrong in pointing to a culture of combative masculinity as a major cause of violence. But they are wrong in thinking that it is peculiarly American, that it is caused by separation from one's mother or an unwillingness to express one's emotions, and that it is an arbitrary social construction that can be deconstructed by verbal commentary. And fans of the public health approach are correct that rates of violence vary with social conditions, but they are wrong in thinking that violence is a pathology in anything like the medical sense. Cultures of honor spring up all over the world because they amplify universal human emotions like pride, anger, revenge, and the love of kith and kin. And because they appear at the time to be sensible responses to local conditions. Indeed, the emotions themselves are thoroughly familiar even when they don't erupt in violence, such as in road rage, office politics, political mudslinging, academic backstabbing, and email flame wars. In Culture of Honor, the social psychologist Richard Nisbet and Dov Cohen show that violent cultures arise in societies that are beyond the reach of the law and in which precious assets are easily stolen. Societies that herd animals meet both conditions. Herders tend to live in territories that are unsuitable for growing crops and thus far from the centers of government. And their major asset, livestock, is easier to steal than the major assets of farmers, land. In herding societies, a man can be stripped of his wealth and of his ability to acquire wealth in an